The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Hello, and welcome to the American College of Osteopathic Internists annual convention and scientific sessions. This year's meeting was held in conjunction with the annual clinical assembly of the American College of Osteopathic Surgeons. The meeting was held October 11th through 15th, 2017, and featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of interest to the practicing physician. The meeting was held at the Gaylord National Resort and Convention Center in National Harbor, Maryland. The program chair is Dr. Annette Karen, and the theme for this year's presentations is Goldilocks Medicine, Not Too Little, Not Too Much. Antibiotic prophylaxis for GI endoscopy, the infectious disease specialist perspective, is presented by Dr. Marc-Alain Dury.
Thank you very much. And I just wanted to start by saying the organizers of this conference did a great thing, and one in that repetition is a good thing. But especially repetition from two different disciplines, I think, is interesting because even though Dr. Bragg had sent me his slides and I really tried to work around them, there was some unavoidable places of repetition, but really interesting from the perspective of approaching something from two different disciplines. So with that, I just wanted to get started and say thank you, Dr. Bragg. That was excellent. Oh, I have the clicker, don't I? There you go. I've no disclosures. And with respect to what we're going to go over today, I'm an infectious diseases doctor, so of course I try to get everybody to think like an ID doctor. Talk very quickly about translocation of endogenous bacteria into the bloodstream to kind of give you an idea of how it is that we get these infections. And fortunate for us, even though they do lead to bacteremias, and I think Dr. Bragg did a great job, and I'm going to probably bring up his example several times about how we see these low incidence of bacteremias that occur with medical procedures. In this case, we're going to be talking about GI procedures, but yet we see such higher levels of bacteremias that occur with day-to-day activities such as brushing our teeth or chewing our food. So fortunately, and just like Dr. Bragg had made the point of saying, was that we don't see a high level of infectious endocarditis or other infectious complications with respect to, let's say, prosthetic joint infections. And those are the two things that we're going to be talking mostly about, or at least I'm going to be talking about today, which is mostly complications of infections from a perspective of infectious endocarditis and prosthetic joint infections. So just as was said prior, bacteremias are not a good surrogate marker for consideration of infectious endocarditis or prosthesis. So the next thing we're going to talk about then essentially are that organisms that lead to bacteremias from GI procedures are, again, less likely to cause remote infections, and that's just the nature of those gram-negative organisms. Thankfully, they're not as sticky as something like Staph aureus is. Staph aureus, very, very sticky bug, likes to stick to things. Coag-negative staph likes to stick to things. Unfortunately, the gram-negative rods are not so much that way. Fortunately, GI procedures are mostly low risk for bacteremias. And then, interestingly enough, that there is limited data that exists that antibiotic prophylaxis prior to a GI procedure will actually lead to a decrease in the likelihood of infectious endocarditis. So with that being said, not many studies exist, and in fact, not many examples exist. And in this one study, this is the same study or paper that Dr. Bragg had talked about, too, his 2015 gastrointestinal endoscopy set of guidelines. And in there, only 25 cases of infectious endocarditis have been reported with any sort of temporal association to an endoscopic procedure, and those are some of the studies that actually list them. So not, you know, if we think about the number of GI procedures that are done, and it's a very, very small amount of cases that have been reported. So much of the existing data reflects estimated risk associated with these conventional endoscopic techniques. But there are no new results that are available that can confidently quantify bacteremia rates with some of the newer endoscopic procedures, such as the oral endoscopic myotomy, the endoscopic submucosal dissection, or endoscopic mucosal resection. And then lastly, there really are no data demonstrating a causal association between endoscopic procedures and infectious endocarditis, or that antibiotic prophylaxis prior to endoscopic procedures protects against infectious endocarditis. So I didn't want to bury the lead. I just wanted to put it right out there that that's what we're essentially dealing with. So the rest of this is really kind of understanding what these guidelines say and kind of diving into them. When I was in medical school, there was a long list of conditions that we needed to prophylax for infectious endocarditis before somebody went and had some sort of dental or oral procedures that were done, and thankfully that has whittled down significantly to a list that essentially looks like that. And it's easy to remember, and even though it's harder for me to write test questions for medical students because it's such an easy list to remember, but essentially the number one cause for infective endocarditis is a previous history of infective endocarditis. Any sort of prosthetic cardiac valve will also lead to infective endocarditis during a dental procedure. And then, of course, any cardiac transplant with abnormal valves or any congenital heart disease. So this is essentially what the list has been whittled down to with respect to what we need to do with respect to the prophylactic use of antibiotics for any oral procedures. So the pathogenesis associated here are threefold. One is the most common one, which is a translocation of endogenous bacteria from intralumen into the bloodstream via some sort of mucosal trauma. That's the most likely thing that's going to happen. The next way would be an inoculation of sterile tissues from direct contact with contaminated endoscope or endoscopic accessories. And then lastly, some sort of contrast injection that would result in bacteria being introduced into previously sterile space. So bacteremias may colonize a remote site. This is obviously the thing that we're most concerned about, such as a heart valve or a prosthetic joint resulting in some sort of infection. But as I said, usually with these gram-negative rods, that's not something that we're 100% always concerned about. Of course, if this were something like staph or coag-negative staph, that's a different story. So this is not really a significant problem with regard to GI procedures and organisms, and again, thankfully for that. So these are some of the high-risk procedures that are associated with bacteremia, such as esophageal dilatation, sclerotherapy of varices, and instrumentation of obstructed bile ducts. With esophageal dilatation, the rate of bacteremia following a esophageal bougeonnage was demonstrated to be 12 to 22%. And again, some of these numbers are far less than brushing your teeth twice a day, so something to keep in consideration. Cultured organisms are usually those that are related to the mouth, such as Strep viridans, and then bacteremias are more likely to be frequent with dilatation of malignant strictures than with benign strictures. Of course, with malignant strictures, you're dealing with abnormal tissue that would make it very thin and pliable and allowable for organisms to translocate. And then, of course, any sort of passage of multiple dilators compared with a single dilation. When looking at some of the an older procedure, such as sclerotherapy of varices, these bacteremias are associated and have been as high as 52%, but fortunately with a mean of 14.6 and endoscopic variceal ligation, which is the thing that is done now, is largely replaced sclerotherapy, has been associated, fortunately, with lower rates of bacteremias of anywhere between 1 to 25%, with a mean of almost 10%. And then lastly, with respect to high-risk bacteremia, instrumentation of obstructed bile ducts, and we're going to be hearing about that a little bit more in a moment. So ERCP in patients with non-obstructed bile ducts have been associated with low rates of bacteremia at 6.4%, but that incident increases to 18% in the setting of biliary obstruction because of stones or strictures. So when we think about procedures that are associated with low risk of bacteremias, gastroscopy with or without biopsies associated with rates of bacteremia of about 8%. The observed bacteremia is usually short-lived, about 30 minutes, and not always associated with an infectious adverse event, fortunately. Colonoscopy has rates that have been reported to be about 25%, but a mean of 4.4%, so again, very low. And therapeutic colon procedures, such as a colonic stent insertion, has a mean bacteremia of about 6.3%, and a flex sig has about a mean of about 1%. So again, these are low risks of bacteremias. As I was just reviewing my slides, I put here, so who gets treated, and that was a total rookie move from a non-rookie ID doctor. I really should have said who gets prophylaxed, so forgive me for that. So who gets prophylaxed? This is the list of folks that get prophylaxed. I can't see it from here because my eyes are a little bit older and that writing is a little low, small, but essentially that slide is basically those people that that are getting prophylaxed are those people who are more or less the same people who are being prophylaxed with respect to those that are getting oral procedures that are being done as well. And obviously we want to be very considerate to those people who actually have active GI infections like an ascending cholangitis. So what the group did here for this particular paper is they obviously weighted their evidence, and so we're going to just go through very quickly what they what their summary recommendations are, and they weighted them as the those crosshairs. But because crosshairs is hard for me to say, I'm just going to say stars, so you'll forgive me. So the 4-star was high, a 3-star was moderate level of evidence, a 2-star was low level of evidence, and then there was one in there of their summary recommendations that are very low. So just reviewing these very briefly. That's a hard one to read too. This was a summary slide of the various procedures of individuals that do get prophylaxed. From here, reading them from back here would be a biliary duct obstruction in the absence of cholangitis, a pancreatic cyst, and I think that was for an endoscopic ultrasound with an FNA. I can't read the next one, and I can't read the one underneath. I apologize for that. But those are the ones that are redlined, and I can't read it from here. I'm sorry for my old eyes. So the summary recommendations are here, such that the summary recommendations, number one, is basically recommend against the routine administration of antibiotic prophylaxis solely for the prevention of infectious endocarditis. Of course, this was stated repeatedly by Dr. Bragg, and again, this received a 3-star, so a moderate level of a recommendation. So I think the idea, I remember being a medical student and seeing people prophylax with antibiotics for GI procedures, and I think that is obviously at this point, we are at the point where that's no longer going to be the case. But like Dr. Bragg mentioned, these are guidelines. Please use your clinical judgment. Not every patient is exactly the same. So patients with high-risk cardiac conditions and an established GI tract infections in which Enterococcus is a part of the infecting bacterial flora should receive an antibiotic coverage. This received a 2-star recommendation. I will remind you that Enterococcus bacteremias, especially enterococcal bacteremias that are VRE, are associated and are considered a marker of mortality. 2 separate meta-analyses that were done, both of them with a relative risk. One was 2.3 and the other one was 2.5, so I'll take the mean, about a relative risk of 2.4. Bacteremias associated with VRE are markers of mortality, so we want to be very cautious about our enterococcal and be very aggressive with them. Of course, you're going to want to prophylax with antibiotics that cover enterococcus, such as ampicillin, vancomycin, daptomycin, or linezolid. Recommend against antibiotic prophylaxis before an ERCP when the obstructive biliary tract disease is not suspected or complete biliary drainage is anticipated. And you can see here that got a high level of recommendation. That was a 4-star recommendation. So against antibiotic prophylaxis before ERCP when obstructive biliary tract disease is not suspected or complete biliary drainage is anticipated. Now, on the other hand, this is recommending that antibiotic prophylaxis be administered before ERCP in patients who have had liver transplantation or who have known or suspected biliary obstruction, where there is a possibility of incomplete biliary drainage. Of course, we're going to want to give antibiotics for that. Antibiotics should cover the biliary flora, such as enteric gram-negative organisms, and enterococci should be used and continued after the procedure if biliary drainage is incomplete. So we're going to definitely would want to be treating for any sort of cholangitis there. Recommend against antibiotic prophylaxis before diagnostic endoscopic ultrasound or FNA of solid lesions of the GI tract, but suggest antibiotic administration prior to an endoscopic ultrasound FNA of mediastinal cyst. Suggest administration of prophylactic antibiotics before endoscopic FNA of pancreatic or peripancreatic cyst. And recommend administration of parenteral cefazolin or equivalent to all patients before or undergoing a PEG or a J-tube placement. Recommend that all patients with cirrhosis admitted with GI bleeding should have antibiotic therapy instituted at admission with intravenous ceftriaxone or similar antibiotic. That again got a 4-star recommendation. And recommend against administration of antibiotic prophylaxis before GI endoscopic procedures for patients with synthetic vascular grafts or non-valvular cardiovascular devices, also 4-star recommendation. Recommend against antibiotic prophylaxis for patients with orthopedic prosthesis undergoing any GI endoscopic procedure. And suggest that the administration of an antibiotic prophylaxis before endoscopy of the lower GI tract in patients undergoing continuous or ambulatory peritoneal dialysis. And that was the one that got a 1-star. And with that, I thank you guys very much, and thanks to the organizing committee for having me come on board. Thank you guys.
Any questions related? I think it was pretty straightforward. We got a little bit of the ID perspective in terms of the organisms, and the GI perspectives correlate, so there wasn't a lot of it. I think at this stage, the message is, be very deliberate about adding prophylactic antibiotics to patients in peri procedures that in days of old used to get a ton of antibiotics. And maybe, Mark, you can talk a little bit to us about just prophylaxis in general and the ID's perspective, because I think it's changed a lot over the last few years, in any procedure, not necessarily GI.
Just in terms of surgery or?
Yeah.
Got it, yeah. I mean, the prophylaxis, there are several different ways I think about prophylaxis, and I'll stay away from all the HIV and ID stuff, because obviously we prophylax a lot for that with respect to the individuals with AIDS and stuff, and that obviously has not changed for several decades. But I think that the prophylaxis with respect to various operative procedures has become a lot more sophisticated as we've been able to understand these procedures better and collect basically more data and be able to share it. But I think at this point it's fairly safe to say I still think that cefazolin is still a workhorse before a majority of procedures. But of course, like any other set of guidelines, you have to use your best clinical judgment. When I was doing more hospital epidemiology at the beginning of my career, I'd very regularly be hearing from surgeons, and they would have a particular case with some particular organism that they were particularly concerned about. If it were a penile implant with coag-negative staph, they would want to do something like vancomycin. If there was some sort of problem with Pseudomonas, they would want to prophylax with some sort of anti-pseudomonal, and so they would need to get the permission from ID to not have to use the standard cefazolins that they weren't dinged as a result of those of the various regulatory bodies that were looking after them. And I will say this, those regulatory bodies I think have been very helpful as well, because I think that they've pushed us into a more unified way of thinking about how we do prophylaxis, and so that we're doing the same thing from California to New York and everywhere in between.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
So excellent presentations from both of you. So I have a question for the audience. who has rethought their dental hygiene habits after Dr. Bragg's? All right, never mind. The real question is this.
Forget about that. What about eating?
Well, you know, you got to eat. That's just there. But the real question is, I'm a gastroenterologist, and I do occasionally, less often than the past, has the patient that says, I've got mitral valve prolapse, I've got to have antibiotics, or for whatever, or the prosthesis thing. The patients tell me, the orthopedic surgeons tell them, you must get antibiotics. So the question is there a patient-centered handout to have available so these people can stew over this when you tell them you really don't want to do it? Because otherwise, I just tell the nurses to give them about half a pound of stompicillin, but, you know. But seriously, a patient-centered handout is one of the solutions for this, because they're the one that's worried and unhappy.
This is that fear I told you about a while ago of a world-class expert asking a question, Mel Saltzman from St. Louis. The ASGE has patient handouts for a wide variety of things that we deal with, procedures and diseases. I have never seen one, Mel, on this particular topic. And if you've got a patient whose primary care physician told them they need something, you can probably talk all day and not talk them out of it. So you could show them a study if they can interpret the literature, but I don't know. Short answer to your question is, I've never seen anything like that.
I guess that's kind of the reason we wanted to do this one. Steve.
Hi. Recently, a number of institutions in the United States have been plagued by contaminated scopes with CRE. How are you addressing those issues?
That's a great question. Mark brought that up a little bit in his talk, but maybe, Nate, you can speak to the sterilization process of the scopes themselves.
I think that's a great point, because I think whenever something like that hits the media, it sort of catches on like wildfire. There are equipment companies that are in the process and have already come out with disposable duodenoscopes. Because just to give you a background on all these, it's not all scopes that were thought to be contaminated. It's an idea of contamination of specifically ERCP scopes that have an elevator that lifts the catheter up and down to allow you to cannulate that becomes difficult to clean underneath or around. So with all the advanced medical equipment that we have to clean these scopes and germicides and what have you, it came down to a simple toothbrush that a lot of the cleaning staff would have to be just very vigilant with. So I think moving forward, we've been trying to track our scopes as good as we were before. We're tracking scopes and trying to figure out from a patient event to a scope if you can tie one particular scope that for whatever reason just has not been able to been sterilized properly. Thankfully at our institution we haven't had that. But I think we're tracking our scopes better. We're being more vigilant with the cleaning staff, making sure we're getting under and around those elevators. And I think moving forward, talking about if you have a scope that's associated with a high-risk procedure like that, would it potentially be, although the concern that you have is the cost, would that be worthwhile switching to one of those disposable scopes and seeing if that helps with patient outcomes?
Yeah, recently, a couple of years ago, one of our sister hospitals was one of the first ones to have an outbreak. And one of the problems was not just bacteremia associated with the scope, but it was colonization of those patients with the organisms. Over 300 patients were colonized with the organism after that happened. We're at the point now where after we sterilize the scope, we culture it and hold it for 72 hours before releasing it, which makes all of our gastroenterologists very happy. and makes our administration very happy sitting and waiting for 3 days before the scope is released. I don't know if you've had those experiences or not.
Yeah, and I think that's part of that tracking the scope is actually following it from the cleaning process to when it's ready for next use. So you're right, I think it's an evolving field. And there's even been other reports about using, sometimes we use a bubble reduction basically, it's a GasX Mylocon-containing solution to help with visualization during endoscopy. And there was a report within the last year and a half, where there was a study saying, well, maybe some of that Mylocon residue was actually left in the scope, and could that be sort of a petri dish for future patients? We went through a period of time where we stopped using Mylocon for those procedures, and then we've now kind of eased back into it with a little bit more comfort, knowing that we haven't seen a huge influx of cases of infection.
Yeah, recently there's a very obscure article talking about PCR testing for CRE organisms. And these authors would, at the time of the endoscopy, do a rectal swab for a CRE. This PCR program comes back with a positive, if it's positive, within 3 hours. And what they have suggested is to not worry about holding the scope after this infection if the patient wasn't colonized with a CRE. Sort of an interesting thing that we're looking at.
Yeah,